Hello, this is Dan Lebatard. Welcome to South Beach Sessions. Bob Costas doesn't need much of an introduction. Across all of my lifetime in journalism, this is a guy who has been doing broadcasting and journalism better than just about anybody. Television is not as easy to do as he makes it look. So this time, and this is a guy who had a late night talk show where he interviewed very well. This time he sits down for an interview, and during it, he will cry. He will curse, and he will be interesting in ways that I'm not sure you've heard him before. This is going to be in two parts because we spent a good amount of time with him. This is the first part, and it is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Let's get started with Bob Costas. Welcome to South Beach Sessions. I'm Dan Lebatard, and our guest this week is someone that I've admired forever. He's been an influence. He does television better than just about anyone has ever done television, and there are very few broadcast careers or journalism careers that have the depth and the profundity that this guy's does. So Bob Costas with us now on South Beach Sessions. And I just wanted to talk to you basically about your entire career. I don't know whether we have enough time or not, because you have been around the most glorious of sports broadcasting events. But before that, when you were getting started, like, what kind of kid were you? Were you like meticulous, prepared? Were you somebody? Because you can't do television the way you do without being someone who is very good at the details.
You know, I don't think I fit any category as a kid. I wasn't a jock, but I wasn't as bad at sports as I allow people to portray it. Because when you're standing there at 5'6" and maybe you're reaching up to Doug Collins, who's a foot taller, or even interviewing Shaquille O'Neal, or you're surrounded by Hall of Famers in one sport or another, I get it. I play along. But I was actually a decent schoolyard sandlot ball player. I tried out for my high school, and while I was the last guy cut, we all had to shoot 100 free throws in braces of 25. Now, this is in rhythm with nobody guarding you, obviously, and somebody's rebounding for you. But I made 91 out of 100. And the coach, who had come close to playing in the NBA, he'd been like a Division II All-American, the coach said, I'd like to keep you, but in order for you to get off your shot, I'd have to run an offense with a triple screen, and I just can't do that. And I can't cut somebody so I can keep you to shoot technicals, so you're gone. And the baseball coach, all I wanted was to be the second string second baseman, but he cut me too. He had played in the Pirates organization back when the minor leagues went as deep as D-ball, and I think he might have gotten as high as C as a pitcher in the Pirate organization. He was also the math teacher. You know how that works in high school. And when he cut me, he said, you know, Costas, you're not bad with the glove, but I don't think you can hit your weight, and I don't think you weigh 130, which might have been true in high school. And then he said, a very prescient man, he said, have you ever thought about broadcasting? I said, yeah, that's pretty much all I think about. I was 16 years old. He goes, good, try that, because you can't help us. And that's how he cut me.
So you knew earlier than that, even though, what you wanted. You had it figured out that early, huh?
Yeah, you know, I realized that if I was ever going to get into Yankee Stadium without buying a ticket, it would be to sit where Red Barber and Mel Allen were sitting and not to stand where Mickey Mantle was standing. And as I followed sports, and I'm sure I wasn't alone in this, as I followed sports, I could not divorce the voices from the events. And like many kids, you might have been playing wiffle ball or throwing a tennis ball against a wall, just playing some solitary game in your head, or shooting baskets. I could hear Marty Glickman and Marv Albert, or Lindsey Nelson and Jack Whitaker, and Mel Allen and Red Barber and Vin Scully. So that's what I wanted to do. And when I read in a Nick yearbook in the late 1960s that both Marty Glickman and Marv Albert had gone to Syracuse, that was good enough for me. And I got into that procession of Syracuse broadcasters fairly early on. Now we're everywhere. Now there's just dozens and dozens of us everywhere you turn in sports broadcasting. So yeah. But to answer your first question, though, Dan, I don't think I fit any category. I was reasonably intelligent, I guess, but I wasn't a brain. I wasn't a guy who studied all the time. I did well in the courses that interested me, like history and English and literature, and not so well at science. And I really sucked at shop. They wanted you to make like a wooden bench of some kind. And you couldn't really cheat off somebody else like you could off other exams. I flunked that course. So I wasn't really a brainiac.
I didn't fit any particular group. I wasn't a preppy character. I wasn't one of the greasers who hung around. In fact, the greasers, I think, wanted to beat me up, but I managed to evade them.
So you weren't popular necessarily. You weren't unpopular. You didn't fit in any of the groups, but clearly you had a facility with words, or is that because you don't speak with a hiccup. You have uncommonly clean conversation in the way that you speak. And that can't have been from the beginning. That has to be something that is Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hours of expertise, right? Like you weren't a savant, right? Right?
No, I developed it along the way, but I was always a pretty verbal kid, and I was pretty popular. I guess there were certain people who I annoyed because I was known to make sarcastic remarks. I wasn't the class clown, but I got off some lines that brought laughs.
I remember when you would do the late night talk show circuit at the height of late night television. And hell, mm-hmm. your show was after Letterman's, right? Your show had a good run after Letterman's, right?
It was Johnny Carson starting when I started in 88. It was Johnny Carson, David Letterman, and then me. And when Carson left in 92, then it became Leno and still for a little while Letterman and then me. And then it was Leno, Conan, and me. And I left the show in the mid-90s, and it's still a regret of mine. At that time, there was so much on the plate, and my kids were young, and I was commuting between St. Louis and New York, and something had to come off a very jammed schedule. NBC had the Olympics. We had the NBA. We still had the NFL. We were getting baseball back. And so I left later, and I still regret that because in many ways, it gave me a chance to do some things that I haven't been able to duplicate since.
Do you have a lot of regrets like that?
Oh, some. Not too many. You know, there's always things you'd like to take back or have a do-over on. Al Michaels and others have said this. There's really no such thing as a perfect broadcast. Maybe some of the very best have had a few. I can't name many that I would call perfect. I can think of some I might have gotten an A on. I don't know about an A+. But that comes with the territory. When you're hard on yourself, if there's a legitimate criticism, as opposed to all the nonsense that's out there about everybody and everything, if there's a legitimate criticism, I've probably thought of it myself already.
Later with Bob Costas was a really good show. You enjoyed doing it, right?
I did. And people have asked me sometimes, could you go back and do a show like that today? I think I could do it competently. But I couldn't do it as well because I was organically connected to almost all the subjects. When I started, I was in my mid-30s. When I left it, I was in my early 40s. So almost everybody was within my frame of reference culturally, whether it was politics, music, movies, literature, the occasional sports guest, other people in broadcasting. Now, you know, could I interview Taylor Swift? Sure, I could. Could I interview Ed Sheeran? Sure, I could. But I wouldn't have the same feel as I had interviewing Paul McCartney. Just wouldn't work that way.
Can you explain to me how it would have worked out differently, like in your imagination, if I take away the regret and say, okay, go back to 1994 and just keep doing Later with Bob Costas and get rid of some other things. Then where does your career go? Like where does Later with Bob Costas end?
I think it probably would have ended around 2000. Instead of 1994. Footnote, the person who succeeded me was Greg Kinnear, who had bigger fish to fry because he's gone on to a terrific career as an actor. But at that time, his claim to fame was Talk Soup. And so they plucked him out of that, and he did Later for a couple of years. And then the franchise just kind of petered out with multiple hosts after that. But I think I probably could have kept going with it till around 2000. But I would have really been burning the candle at both ends. I don't know what I would have given up football. I did give up football for the first time in 1993. But I wouldn't have wanted at that point to leave the Olympics. Certainly wouldn't have wanted to have left the NBA on NBC. That was a glorious era. And even though we didn't have the full-fledged baseball that we had prior to the 90s, we did have a piece of baseball for part of the 90s and into the early 2000s. So I wouldn't have wanted to give that up. So I don't know.
Are any of those jobs the one that you would classify as here's where I had the most fun?
From the late 80s to the early 90s, the combination of things that I did not only were good television, I really think they were truthful to who I was. I think nobody's public persona is exactly who they are in all respects, But I think during that period of time, it came about as close for me as it can for anybody, because there was serious stuff. There was goofy, lighthearted stuff. There was play-by-play. There was hosting. There was interviewing. There was commentary. So I'd be doing Later with Bob Costas. And in a given week, the guests could be Elie Wiesel talking about the Holocaust, Soupy Sales talking about throwing a pie in somebody's face, Hank Aaron talking about chasing down Babe Ruth, Mary Tyler Moore talking about her program, Ronnie Spector talking about Phil Spector's genius and demons. All those things could have happened in the space of a week. And at the same time, baseball, basketball during an incredible era, the NBA on NBC and the Jordan era, but I was also showing up on Nightline if they needed some commentary about a sports thing, or on Meet the Press, or on Charlie Rose's program. I was one of the people in Ken Burns' baseball. I'd fill in occasionally on the Today Show. When I left Later, they had me doing genuine profiles. This doesn't exist anymore on network TV except for 60 Minutes. But then there were news magazines that actually were news magazines. So I was doing profiles of people from Ray Charles to Bob Knight and other points on the spectrum. So I think that that was as true an example of who I was as a person and a broadcaster as you could ever find. And then over the last 15 years or so, I think some of what I did, I hope all of it was professionally competent, but some of it was true to me, and others were just craftsmanship.
When was the last time Bob Costas was truly nervous before a broadcast?
It's a great question. I wasn't nervous in Sochi going on the air with Pink Eye. I was annoyed, maybe a little bit physically uncomfortable, but that's not the answer.
We can come back to it. I'm most curious, though, about where your confidence there comes from, because it's an extraordinary confidence to have. You never look to me like you're nervous on television. You've lived an entire life on television, but the grace with which you handle the chaos and the frenetic pace of television it's uncommon as a skill. I'm not even sure many people understand that it's a skill. And so that's the reason that I asked the question.
Well, you're supposed to, especially when you're hosting and you're on camera, you're supposed to make it look relatively easy. Otherwise, the audience would be uncomfortable. They're not supposed to see all the pulleys and levers at work behind the scenes. It'd be like going back behind the curtain at a Broadway show. So they're not supposed to be able to tell all the time whether you're reading from a teleprompter or whether you're ad-libbing. Sometimes people would say to me, did you ad-lib that? Or did you, couldn't tell the difference. So I guess that's a good thing. I used to sometimes, and some of my colleagues would chide me about it. I didn't make it happen on purpose. I didn't sabotage things on purpose, but I sometimes liked it when things went off the rails and you had to ad-lib and you had to break that fourth wall. I liked that a lot, and usually it turned out okay.
Who are the people that you would look like over the course of your career that you would look at and say, man, that person is uncommonly skilled at the doing of television?
I don't know if he's so much a television person, although obviously he did great work on television, but all of us in sports broadcasting look with awe upon Vin Scully. So flawless and yet so human. You got a sense of who he was over the course of time. There are other great broadcasters, but he's kind of in a category of his own. Early on, back when he was doing a morning show on NBC, even before he landed at 12:30, I picked up on David Letterman, and I think I got where he was coming from. And the way he was able to remake late-night television, he was often offering homages to his hero, Johnny Carson, and there's no criticism to offer of Johnny Carson. He was beyond wonderful. But David didn't copy Johnny. He wasn't a pale imitation of Johnny. He remade the whole form. So there was that. Koppel was somebody I admired because he was able to take a basic story and then advance it. He usually wasn't out there, at least once he became super famous hosting Nightline. He wasn't out there reporting stories. He was advancing the stories with interviews involving the principals or people who had some kind of perspective on whatever the story was. And he had an extraordinarily broad range. Didn't include sports, by the way, which he happily admitted. He was not that much of a sports fan. But apart from that, there weren't too many gaps in his frame of reference.
Did you, while making the talk show circuit, as you would, like being on these shows, do you have any one thing that you remember from any of them that stands out to you? Because you're basically skipping across a different time in television, a different time in America. Like when you're talking about what you were doing in the 80s and 90s, you're segueing from Carson to Letterman to from three network channels in some ways to cable television. Like everything was changing back then.
Yeah, it was. I found kind of a comfort zone for me, a territory that I felt comfortable residing in. And I haven't changed all that much. Certainly you want to be properly familiar with the subjects you're covering, but I haven't changed my approach to chase whatever the trend of the moment is. And I guess I just landed in the 80s, 90s, early 2000s. And in the early 2000s, I forgot to mention earlier, my stint at HBO was very true to who I was as a person and a broadcaster. I just was lucky to land in a number of places that I fit organically. The thing I really remember in terms of appearing on Letterman and Leno and Conan, and one time, which I'll never forget, with Johnny Carson a month before he left The Tonight Show, those worked out pretty well for me. The very first one was in April of 1982. Letterman had started in late night on NBC in February. So he's new at it, and he's beginning to incorporate these crazy ideas, like when he turned himself into a human Alka-Seltzer tablet, or he Velcroed himself and jumped up against a wall and stuck. So one of his ideas was elevator races. They took two people from the audience. They handed them faux Olympic torches. They had them run down the hall on the sixth floor, get on the elevator, go down into the lobby at 30 Rock, run around the block, come back, ascend on the elevator, and whoever re-entered the studio first would win the elevator race. So they needed someone to offer a mock serious ongoing commentary of this epic event. And they called NBC Sports, and they're looking for Don Crickey. They're looking for Marv Albert. Nobody's around. A secretary says, "We got a kid here named Bob Costas." They say, "Send him over." David, who later became a champion of mine and really helped my career, whether he realizes it or not, because appearing on his show gave me a certain kind of confidence to be more spontaneous and a little bit more irreverent in other contexts. David, at that point, has no idea who I am and introduces me as Bob Costa, which was just fine by me because I was happy to be on the show. And I guess I got what he wanted and made him laugh, made the audience laugh. And then they started bringing me back for other things. There was a program celebrating a third anniversary, and I think you can find it on YouTube somewhere, where they were going to crown a late night baby who would have incredible lifelong benefits for being born during the live program, during that hour. So I'm at one hospital, and who's at the other? Vince McMahon, a person who I would intersect with in a different context later. It turns out that the baby is born at McMahon's hospital while they're taping the show. I come up empty, but they cut to me at the end, and I'm standing there, and they've got an ongoing party. Here are the doctors, the nurses, the orderlies. They're wearing party hats. They've got noisemakers. There's a big cake. They're passing out cigars. So I'm brandishing a cigar, and I say, "David, no baby yet, but why not have a party?" And here's the scene. And I said, meanwhile, down the hall, the plaintive cries of desperately ill men and women go unheeded. And Letterman liked that so much.
Oh, what a great line.
And they cut to Letterman, and he's throwing his head back, and you know, he's there laughing like crazy.
Such a dark joke for you to go for in that situation.
It was 1985.
How old were you?
32. So now Letterman, a couple years later, says to Dick Ebersol that he had listened to my Sunday night radio show. And again, it's a different landscape. I did this syndicated radio show on Sunday nights. This is before All Talk all sports talk radio stations even existed. So 2 hours on some 300 stations around the country on a Sunday night. There was no Sunday night baseball. There was no Sunday night football yet. So it garnered a large audience, and Letterman was a sports fan, and he'd sometimes listen to it driving around in his car. And he said to Dick Ebersol, hey, if Bob Costas can interview Bart Starr for an hour, why can't he interview people outside of sports? And that actually was the germ of the idea. And Dick and Brandon Tartikoff then created later with me in mind.
Is that the point in your early 30s when you realized that you could cross over from sports into other things? Because certainly late night television would be a gateway to that.
I never had that particular ambition. You know, I never had a specific plan. Things just kind of happened. When I started out at Syracuse, I thought I could be, if I was lucky, the radio voice of a baseball team someday, and then maybe do basketball in the offseason. I thought about radio. And when I was at KMOX in St. Louis, I didn't think about television. And I got into it little by little. Don Ohlmeyer at NBC saw some of the regional games I'd done on CBS TV. He hired me when I was just 27 years old. And I'm thinking, hey, this is great. I'm doing some basketball, some football, some baseball on network TV. Then Bryant Gumbel goes to the Today Show in the early 80s, and I had hosted one thing for them. It was the All-Star Game in 1983. Vin Scully and Joe Garagiola called it. It was at the old Comiskey Park, 50th anniversary of the All-Star Game. So I hosted this thing, and I ad-libbed all of it. I never used a teleprompter at all until 1988, the first time I did an Olympics. So I ad-libbed it, and Mike Weissman, who then was running NBC Sports, having succeeded Ohlmeyer, Weissman says, we really like this, and we think you should succeed Bryant Gumbel. And I'm trying to explain to them, I have no experience doing this. They said, you'll figure it out. So I sat down and I figured it out.
You mentioned the McMahon interview. Like, in terms of interviews you've done in your life, what ranks as the most memorable one? What ranks?
Well, that's on the list. The answer to your earlier question about feeling nervous, I'm sure I felt nervous some other time in the ensuing 30 years. But when I interviewed Paul McCartney on Later, it's just different than interviewing Bruce Springsteen. It's just different because Bruce Springsteen, as great as he is a contemporary of mine. Paul McCartney sits down. He couldn't have been more easygoing and down to earth, which made it much easier. But when he sits down, I'm thinking of myself being 11 years old in my parents' living room, watching Paul McCartney and the Beatles make their debut on the Ed Sullivan Show, major cultural event. And I'm sitting there thinking, wow, I wonder if any of the kids I went to grade school and high school with are watching this now. Here's Bobby Costas talking to Paul McCartney. So that would be a time I was nervous. People still talk to me about the Vince McMahon thing, and they think that must have been one of your more difficult interviews. Maybe for some people, but for me, the most difficult ones are the people who are boring and just not forthcoming. So it's like pulling teeth. If it's controversial or combative, as long as you're up to the task, then you know it's good TV. And that happened to be live on HBO, live and with no commercials. It was supposed to be 15 minutes, wound up going close to half an hour. Some people think, especially if they don't know me and know what my motivations are, people think about all TV people that their only objective is to call attention to themselves. I can honestly say, my hand to God, my only objective is to do as good a broadcast as I possibly can. Of course, you don't want it to happen in a vacuum. Of course, you want people to see it. But if you wanted the maximum possible audience, you wouldn't be on HBO. You go to HBO because you want to do quality stuff. So I asked McMahon what I thought were pertinent questions with the XFL and its first iteration going down in flames. And Vince has had this experience before. You can ask Armin Katayan and others about it. He slapped the notes out of Armin Katayan's hand on another occasion. You know, he was used to orchestrated interviews done in a wrestling context. And I was asking him the kind of questions he'd be asked if he was on Meet the Press. And it got more and more heated. And I've said this many times. Vince is not dumb. He's smart. A transcript of this interview, if you read it, you might call it a draw. In the minds of his loyalists, he kicked my ass figuratively. But I think in the minds of many other people, I won on tone. He lost it and I stayed calm. And on television, that's a factor.
All of that is so fascinating. First, let's go back to where you were with McCartney. Do you remember whether you asked good questions? Did you do a good interview?
I think so. It was a three-parter. We taped for an hour. As you know, 22 minutes comprises a half-hour television show with an open, close, and the commercials. And so when we threw in some clips of him and the Beatles, we were able to get three shows out of it. And he was a great guest. And after about 2 or 3 minutes, I was pretty much at ease. And I think this is true of any subject. I'm sure you found it to be true as well. If you've done your preparation and you show enough respect for the person that he or she knows that you put some time into this, you don't have to fawn over them. You've shown them enough respect and their work enough respect, and by extension, enough respect for the audience to not just ask boilerplate questions, but that you're really here to try and engage the person and find out something interesting about them. I think they tend to respond to that. Not everybody, but if you do your part, they'll do theirs. And what often happens, there's a difference between the kind of interview we're doing now and the kind of interview I used to do in late night on NBC. That's different than a newsmaker interview where there are always specific issues to get to. In the kind of sometimes rambling conversation or biographical conversation that I did on later, very often the best stuff didn't seem to come in response to a pointed question. Once the person was at ease and comfortable and trusted that this was going to be worthwhile, very often they just gave it up. And it wasn't like anything you specifically did, but you created an atmosphere, and the producers of the show create an atmosphere in which good things happened.
What would you identify as where you'd give yourself an A+? The work that you've done where you're like, you know what? I was really proud of this. There was a degree of difficulty involved, and what I was able to do here is something that gives me pride.
Well, I try not to have too many of those because you can almost always do better. But one that comes to mind because it's currently on people's radar, Michael Jordan's last game, which obviously they'll focus on in the 10th and final episode of The Last Dance. Michael Jordan's last game in Utah in 1998, I think my call of the last shot and everything that led up to it, and then kind of the contextualizing comments made around the replays and in and around the comments that Doug Collins and Isaiah Thomas made, I think they hold up pretty darn well more than 20 years later. And then subsequent to that, after Ahmad Rashad had done a very good job with the celebration and the interviews, and after Zeke and Doug had offered their closing comments, they came to me, and I did a kind of off-the-cuff essay about Jordan and the Bulls. We all had a sense that this was where it was going to end, about what this meant, not just that year's NBA championship, but the whole era. And I said something about how the structure of sports was changing, and we may see teams this good again, but we may not see teams whose identity sustains for as long as Jordan and the Bulls did, or even as the Jazz with Malone and Stockton had, because the structure of sports was changing, and we wouldn't be able to identify with as many teams that way as we had previously. And that's floating around, people tell me, somewhere on YouTube, and I think that holds up pretty well 2 decades later. So if I had to pick one that pops to mind, I would say I was on my game that night in Utah.
What would you point to as some of the greatest perks of being Bob Costas, professional broadcaster and famous person across decades? Like in terms of, you know, you've made appearances in, you know, movies, mm-hmm. or on television shows, or you managed a spring training baseball game. I know how much you love baseball. Like when you go to the top of the list of things where you're like, how the hell did I get here to get to do this? What are you seeing?
You know, this may seem trite, maybe because it is trite, but I've thought this for a very long time. There are a number of doctors in my family, my extended family. They're wonderful at what they do. Other than those they directly interact with, if they're walking down the street or they're at the checkout line in the supermarket, nobody says to them, hey, what a wonderful job you did with that kid who has cancer. What a wonderful job you did saving that young woman's eyesight. One of my relatives is a retinal surgeon. That doesn't happen. But people like you and me and others in our profession are apt to be walking down the street and somebody says, Bob, love your work. Or they'll even cite a specific thing, a specific interview or a specific call. That is such an enormous perk to be reminded that there are people out there who enjoy and remember what you've done. Also being mindful there are people out there that don't like you at all. But that comes with the territory, and it's well worth the trade-off.
That's cool that you're going with something. I don't think it's trite that you're going with something that's sort of priceless. And I would say that I had looked past, that I have sort of taken for granted because I hadn't considered the idea that people who are great at their work don't often have others coming up to them the way that we do. Hey, thanks for bringing me through a dark time, or some of these amazing compliments that we get for the stupidity that we do. But I also imagine, though, that there are some places that you ended up that were also cool.
Yes. Before I answer that, something else comes to mind, and it's a version of what we were just talking about. Maybe 10 years ago, I'm hailing a cab in Columbus Circle in New York, and the cab pulls up, and it's letting its other passenger out. The door opens, guy gets out of the back seat, and I'm standing there with my daughter about to get in the cab. The guy looks at me, and he says, Bob, I always hoped I could meet you. When my dad was dying, he wrote to you like 20 years ago and wanted to send you some old New York Giants, baseball Giants programs. He had followed them since the days of Carl Hubbell and on to Willie Mays as a young New York Giant. And I recalled this when he mentioned it, that I had received these items because he wanted them to be in the hands of somebody he thought loved baseball as much as he did. And then this guy says, and you wrote back to my dad, and then you called him after that. And that meant so much to him. So I thanked the man, slapped him on the back, told him that was lovely. And we get in the cab, and my daughter, who had known that I was on television since she was able to think about the whole thing, she said, that's why I'm proud that you're my dad.
Is that emotion? Is that emotion from Bob Costas? Or are you just drinking something?
It's not yet noon on the West Coast, so no.
I don't think of you as someone who the mask ever comes off on. Like, I guess it shouldn't be surprising that you have human emotion, but I don't think of you as somebody who would dissolve in the face of something like that. But, I even understanding that it's deeply moving. Is it your daughter there, or is it impact? Is it the combination of the things?
I think it's a combination of it. The fact that it involved my daughter, certainly a big part of it. You know, I did the eulogies for both Mickey Mantle and Stan Musial some two decades apart. The families of Mickey and Stan asked me to do it. In both instances, I wanted to speak in some sense, not just for myself, but for everyone who had followed them and everyone for whom Mickey Mantle or Stan Musial meant something. I wanted to capture some of what made them matter beyond their excellence as baseball players. And I got to the story that many people hadn't heard before, but I had heard it independently over the years from both Hank Aaron and Willie Mays. And it was told to illustrate what a basically decent man Stan Musial was. And Stan, in the mid-1950s, in the National League clubhouse at an All-Star game, observed that all the black players on the squad, Ernie Banks, Frank Robinson, Hank Aaron, Willie Mays, were by themselves in a corner playing cards. And all the white players were elsewhere in the clubhouse. And Stan just walked over and said, deal me in. That meant so much to Aaron and Mays in 1957 or whatever it was, that they remembered it decades later. But the thought that I was trying to put across in a church in St. Louis is, yeah, it meant a great deal. Not insignificantly, by the way. Stan Musial had played on integrated teams in the 1930s in Denora, Pennsylvania, teams that included Ken Griffey Jr.'s grandfather, not his dad, but his grandfather. So he was always an enlightened guy when it came to issues of race. But I thought a larger point was, think what that meant to the other white players in that clubhouse, many of whom were from the still Jim Crow South. This is the 1950s. To see the most accomplished and respected among them, Musial was toward the end of his career, the most respected among them made made that simple, decent gesture. And very often for me, everybody's different. I sometimes get choked up when I see something that's an example of grace or decency or kindness. That's more apt to choke me up than something that on the face of it seems sad. I had to stop telling that story about Sam.
Our thanks to Bob Costas. That's only half of our conversation. So if you enjoyed that, and even if you didn't enjoy that, next week you're going to get the second half. And he is spicy in the second half of that conversation. While we're at it, though, we should tell you about Stupidity. And I'm told the newest episode of Stupidity has the most famous guest in the world. That I'm not going to believe the interview that Stu Gatz does. And it feels like a joke. It sounds like a trick. But I'm told it's not a trick. I'm told he's got a great guest on Stupidity. So check that out on the Le Batard and Friends Network. Thanks. We'll talk to you again next week.